Welcome to a very special episode of the Florida Specifier podcast, and I'm your solo host today. My name is Brett Cyphers, and I'm holding the fort down for my usual co-host, Ryan Matthews. And I say this is a special podcast because I want to devote some time to talking with two of the, I'll call them four mothers of environmental permitting summer school. They were very instrumental in those early days. And this is, we're talking about the mid 80s here and then to the, you know, obviously the 90s and today. Of course, that means I'm joined by Linda Dickinson and Cindy Littlejohn. Thanks for being here, you two. So let's start with some individual origin stories. And we talked a little bit just before we started recording about you, Linda. I would suggest if people want to know more about Cindy, she has a podcast probably by the time you're hearing this. Hers may be out. But check that out and you can hear all about her and her wonderful books. And I encourage you to do that. But let's start with just some basics. Linda, where are you from? And let's walk me up to the point where you met up with Chuck Littlejohn and, you know, in the chamber.
I grew up in Chipley, Florida, where my mother was actually from and my dad retired to after spending 20 years in the Air Force. He was from Wewahitchka, so we didn't travel far. I graduated from high school, came over to Tallahassee with the intent of becoming a court reporter. But I got married young. I had to go to work and ended up going to work for the state of Florida with the Secretary of State's office and then moved on and worked under Graham in the governor's office for a couple of years in their legislative and legal office. And I was, for some reason, deciding that I didn't think state government was going to be my thing and started talking to a lot of different lobbyists and stuff that were coming in through the doors. And somebody told me that Chuck Littlejohn was looking for a secretary. And so I submitted a resume and went to lunch with Chuck and he hired me. And here we are. Right before session started in March of 1984, and he hired me. And we hit the ground running, as you can tell from when these courses started right after that. So, yeah.
And did you do other kinds of work with Chuck as well? Because you said just before March of 84, which means just before session started in those days.
Yes.
And so did you do not just...
I was his secretary, and I split time with him and an attorney that he shared an office with named Richard Bush. And so I was kind of both of their secretaries, and I was actually being paid by initially a client of Chuck's, which was an engineering firm called Startler Stagg and Associates. And I remember, this is kind of funny to me, and it'll be funny to people in today's term. This was back in 1984, like I said. I left the governor's office making $12,400 a year, and I got a huge, whopping big raise up to $13,600 a year. And
impressive.
I thought I had scored big.
Oh, boy. And Cindy, how about you? Talk a little bit about, you know, that those parts leading up to maybe even to the point where, I mean, because you connected with Chuck even before you end up being
married to Chuck. And so maybe talk a little bit about yourself professionally leading into that connection.
Okay. I worked for the Florida Chamber of Commerce, and Chuck was already working with them. When I came to work, I think he was already a contract consultant, lobbyist, etc. I really didn't notice Chuck for a good while. I was married when I first started working for the chamber, but I went through a divorce, and I'll never forget the first time I really noticed him in that way. I was at a, these courses started in Tallahassee before it went down to Marco, and it was over there at FSU. I was standing with Linda and Colleen, and we were watching stuff going on downstairs. It was like an atrium. An old girlfriend of Chuck's came up to him, and I think Colleen and Linda didn't like her. Because all of a sudden, Colleen says, "Linda, go down there and break that up." And I thought, what in the world is going on? So Linda took off down there, but she didn't have to break it up because Chuck whatever was said between the two of them, Chuck just turned around and walked off. Oh. And then he came back upstairs with Linda, and that's the first time I really talked to Chuck. Wasn't too long after that, Linda called me and said, Chuck wants you to meet him. I think it was for lunch to go over a letter that he wanted our membership department to write to people that came to the short course that weren't members of the chamber. Huh. And I said, okay. And then Linda called that day and she said, he's busy and he's going to need to meet you after work if you're available for drinks. And I thought, okay. And that's where it all started.
Nice.
It was due to these courses.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I was curious about that going into this, is like how much of it played into that actual connection. But let's do me a favor. Let's talk about Chuck first, then we'll talk about the invention of the short course. What was Chuck like back in those days?
Well, from my perspective, he was, and he was like this throughout his entire work career to me. Chuck was always, I think in all the time that he and I worked together, we had one, quote, tense moment where I was like, I can't do this. And I got mad and I left and I went to the gym and worked out and I came back. We never yelled at each other. He was always the ultimate compromiser, always willing to listen, always willing to work with somebody, hard worker, but calm as a cucumber. And I was the opposite of that. So I guess that's why we worked. I have a more intense personality and I'm always like, hurry, hurry, hurry. And Chuck does not hurry. It may take a long time, but we get there. So that's my read on it. And
I don't know when Chuck figured out how positive that could be, but by the time I came along, that it was obvious to me he was using good cop, bad cop.
I was about to say, yeah.
He'd send her over to
absolutely. I was Chuck's work wife, for lack of a better term, for years. And I used to tell people all the time, they used to come up to me all the time and say, well, Chuck said, and I said, well, that was your first mistake because you asked the wrong person.
What about you? What about you, Sydney? What was your impression after your kind of quasi first date and you started, spending more time around each other? What was your impression of him at that point?
My first attraction to Chuck Littlejohn was his mind. I mean, he is a brilliant person. He really is. And I think people underestimate him at times. And she's right. It's not that he compromises. He just knows how to bring people to the table and get them to agree on things. And that's why he played such an important role between business and agriculture and the environmental community. He was the person that everybody went to work out problems. It was really amazing.
Yeah, I mean, he was certainly, of course, I didn't meet Chuck until probably 2002-ish, but that was always my impression in those days as well, which is I could see him speak in committee and I could call him afterwards. In those days, I worked for Governor Bush, and I would call him up on the phone, and he would either talk me through something in terms of, his perspective or even someone else's perspective in terms of kind of steel manning, other people's arguments. So he was always, in my mind, very, very reliable, very clear thinker, clear speaker.
Very clear thinker.
Yeah.
I mean, he'd show you a different way to look at something. It was amazing. Yeah. Absolutely amazing.
Is that why, and if he's talked about it before, which is the why start the, back then called the short course, right? Mm-hmm. Was that why he wanted to do it? Was he felt like something was missing?
Well, it really kind of started from his relationship with the Florida Chamber, and he was getting inundated with phone calls from members of the chamber, wanting pretty much like free advice, free legal advice, free engineering advice, like what do I do here, what do I do there, if they got to get a permit or whatever kind of thing, and that just he started thinking, you know, people need to have a place where they can go and learn this stuff. And just the, you know, ordinary practitioner that's working in the fields, a go-to place, because we also used to do he put together, I think this was, I can't remember if it was right in tandem with the first short course or it was shortly thereafter, we put together an environmental permitting guide. And it was kind of a guide on, here would be a little tab on, say, air quality or water quality or stormwater or whatever. And it kind of walked you through what the rules and the laws were that kind of took over that section. So
I have a copy of one of those.
Do you?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And it's in a cedar chest that's all Chuck's stuff, you know.
Yeah. So, I mean, did that, and then, you know, went, that moved into having a publication called The Environmental Network, which again was, you know, a combination of putting together different things. But the short course came from being just inundated with questions, and he thought, well, we'll just put on a conference where people can come and learn, and had no idea that it would last as long as it lasted, or that it would even it become as big as it has become. And we even used to do small conferences that were a day, day and a half, when different laws would pass, or after a legislative session, we would take one on the road to let people know. We'd go to maybe five different cities and say, okay, this is what happened during the last legislative session. Or when the Wetlands Act passed back in the 80s, we took that on the road and kind of educated everybody on what was going on with that.
Solid
was
waste. That was one of those, I remember.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, what were the things that were most capturing people's attention? And I kind of look at, I think,
the Growth Management Act.
Yeah,
so that was the biggie.
Yeah, that was big.
In fact, I went back and looked at the list of issues that he was taking on from year to year. We actually did a list years ago. And in 1986, in 1985, that list was maybe 8 to 10 issues. Mm. 1986, 40 issues.
Oh, wow.
In 1 year. And the Growth Management Act was in that first 84. Mm-hmm. And it was the big one. He was literally hired days before that session. And that thing, you know, was staring him in the face.
Yeah.
And this was back when, I mean, you know, we had a Department of Natural Resources before we ever had the Department of Community Affairs and all that, when they split all that up.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and those were huge years. And I guess maybe it becomes a matter of just wait. If everyone is calling Chuck and saying, I need you to, you know, travel and explain this to us, whether it's some new regulation, which it was a lot of new laws.
Well, the big thing that happened was the state just started filling up with people. I mean, when I worked at the chamber, see, I was at the chamber from 84 to 88 during that period, and we were gaining 1,000 a day, which was crazy after what had happened in the 60s and 70s. I mean, we were nowhere near those numbers. And so people were freaking out. And on top of it, you had those giant freezes that took out all the citrus in the Orlando area. Mm-hmm. And that's when all of a sudden they're just building houses, because citrus moved south. It went to Southwest Florida.
Yeah.
And a lot of people think that the housing came first and pushed the citrus out. That wasn't what happened. Mm. You had those freezes, and citrus left that area and went farther south, where they didn't have to worry with having a freeze like that. Because at the time, remember, the earth was cooling at that time,
right.
According to our scientists.
It certainly was where I grew up. I mean, it was nightly news. You were up at 11 p.m. I was allowed to watch the news in those days. And this is East Hillsborough County, Sefner, Dover, Valrico, heading toward Plant City. And it was all strawberry fields and orange groves. And it was a huge deal back then. I guess we had a really bad freeze last year?
Right.
And that was incredible. But yeah, it's
So that Growth Management
Act
just ran over business in the state of Florida. And they didn't understand it. Chuck came to the table with an environmental engineering background, and he was actually hired into the governor's office with the old planning office of planning. Mm. That was his first job with the state, and it was in the 70s under Reuben Askew. And so there really were no growth management laws back then. You know, right. They were thinking about it. They really weren't. Well, they got to rolling by the middle, right. And that's when business needed help. You know, they didn't understand it. They didn't know how to comply. Chuck told me one time that when he was negotiating with the chamber what they wanted from him, they told him that that was one of the things they wanted from him, where the people were calling them with all these questions that they couldn't answer. Mm. And would he be available to talk to people? And then that fits into what you just talked mm-hmm. about. He basically had to do this to get back to work. He was on the phone too much.
Yeah, I guess maybe, that was kind of leading into my next question, which mm-hmm. was, how did that building process of creating something that didn't exist before, and how do you do it in a way that's the most efficient, you know, for his time and effort, for your time and effort? How did that look like in the early days? Just like, hey, y'all are now event planners. How did that come? Because the first ones were what, here in Tallahassee?
It was total chaos. And we had no idea what we were doing. We did hire, Chuck hired event planners. Well, first of all, we had a joint venture relationship at the time with the Florida Chamber. So we had somebody, quote, sharing in the risk if the whole thing flopped, you know. But it was a matter of just Chuck knowing people, knowing what the hot topics and issues right. were. And we kind of put together a format. And, you know, back in those days, everything was printable. And everything was...
Tell them about those books.
And everything was mailable. And, you know, so we didn't have the internet like we do today. Mm-hmm. And well, we didn't have it at all in the beginning. I remember when I first started working for Chuck, I had a memory typewriter. And then the Apple IIe word processor came out, and it was like, woohoo, you know, we got one of those. So it was a while before technology really took over. So everything was kind of by word of mouth, sending out flyers in the mail. And that first year, which was up here at the Center for Professional Development here in Tallahassee, mm-hmm. we knew that we were going to be putting together, quote, materials for the attendees. And so we decided the best way to do that was to use a three-ring binder. And all of these speakers were supposed to submit their paper.
Their syllabus and their outline.
So we were scrambling trying to get their material in prior to the conference. And I vividly remember the night before the conference, I'm talking at 2 a.m., being in the copy shop, which was in the basement of the chamber. It was a business that was down there, mm-hmm. making copies and putting together these notebooks for the attendees, because we were only giving them the paper for the course that they had selected that they wanted to attend. Chuck did come up with this format of, okay, we're going to teach, you know, 20 courses, but you can only go to 6 of them within the time frame of the conference or whatever, mm-hmm. or 6 or 8 or whatever it was. And so during the conference itself, we're wheeling these things down on carts to go outside of the different doorways for the different panel discussions. Mm-hmm. And anytime somebody decided that they wanted to switch courses and didn't want to take the air quality but wanted to go to the stormwater, they had to come to the desk at the conference center and turn in their paper for the air quality course that they didn't want to go to, and get the one for the stormwater and put it in their three-ring binder.
That sounds like a waking nightmare.
It was crazy.
How many people were at those first ones?
We had over 100. I don't remember exactly, but we had over 100.
Estimating like sheer volume and weight of binders that y'all are coping with.
I remember the binders. They finally got like this.
Yeah, we merged into developing a, pretty much it was like, it looked like a phone book. I mean, an old-fashioned phone book. It was so thick. Because and giving them all the courses and not just the ones you
chose. Tallahassee phone book, a Miami phone
And then
book.
We started producing them on CDs for a few years. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, once technology caught up, everything's online now. And right. Yeah.
My first memory of the books, I was working in the chamber, and all of a sudden, Frank Ryle announces to everybody in the chamber, if you have free time, go down to the conference room and help with the short course materials. And they were down there and
collating,
picking up one at a time. Mm-hmm. Everybody just walking around. It was like, you know, an assembly line making those books.
Wow. I guess it wasn't really all that long ago. I remember even in the Capitol, they were still doing a whole bunch of stuff. It was like pretty much all paper, even to like the early 2000s or so.
Yeah.
Yes.
What was Chuck like in the midst of that? I mean, you said you have 20 courses, so you start out at pretty
Tom
wide
was a
range.
Cucumber.
Yeah.
But I can tell you what he was like at home. And of course, that is not until 1989. That's when we married. He would start in it. He had an upstairs office with a desk and a table. And all of a sudden, I notice both of them are full, and he has moved to the dining room. He fills that one up, and he's got things laid out, you know. It's a mess, but he knows where things are, I guess. And then when I draw the line, it's when he'd move to the breakfast room where we eat. You know, I'm like, no, find another place.
Finally, had to call it. I mean, he came up with all the courses himself? Is
Pretty
that
much? Yeah, some of them were courses done. You know, one reason people say, "Well, why do you think this lasted as long as it did?" They keep changing the rules. They change the statutes. They change the rules.
Right.
It is constant, and people have to keep up.
Yeah,
talking lawyers and engineers and people that work for counties and cities, and you know, and this has become the place that keeps people up on all this.
But through his lobbying business and his connections with people like Frank Matthews and Wade Hoppins of the world and Bill Preston and Steve Lewis and, you know, a lot of the old timers, of which I am one now, you know, they would come to him and different ones would come up with an idea for a course or something. Mm-hmm. And then it was always very important to Chuck. And I think one of the successes of the conference is it was never intended to push an agenda for the Florida Chamber or anybody else. It was intended to be educational and informational. And so it was always really important to Chuck that we had a balanced panel and that you had the people on there that were actual practitioners from maybe the legal aspect or the engineering aspect or the regulator or whatever, so that you had a balanced panel.
Yeah.
And that's carried on to this day. So that's what's made it successful, in my opinion.
And the environmental community was there too. You know, they were on those panels as well.
Yeah,
so got all sides of the issue.
Right. And that's one of the things that, you know, I've noticed over time is it seems like maybe expanded, because we say environmental permitting summer school, but it's a lot more than environmental permitting. You know, it expanded into all of the things that happen related to the environment, including permitting. It was also, it always seemed to me like you were going to hear different perspectives of each one of those things, whether it was some new stormwater rule or, you know, ERP law or growth management or something like that. It's like you were going to get a different perspective than
well,
maybe
back in the late 80s and then into the 90s. I can't even believe that we did all this. Looking back, we worked ourselves to death, because not only did Chuck have his lobbying business that I worked with him in, but we were putting on the environmental permitting short course in Tallahassee. We were putting on the summer school in Marco Island. We were putting on a growth management course in Central Florida in the spring. And then we were putting on a solid and hazardous waste conference in the fall. And then on top of those four big core courses, like I said, when something hot would come out, we would take that on the road and do these like day and a half conferences.
When did you realize that it had gone from, there's this thing where folks that are more insider, and you mentioned a lot of people that were very insidery in Tallahassee and the Capitol in those days. When did you discover that it had gone from this is a thing that 100 folks show up to, and you know they're ones that want to, that really get into the weeds, to it being something where it's like a knot, you cannot miss this conference if you do environmental stuff for a living?
I'd say pretty early on. I mean, I think the only, in my memory, the only game in town back then to get information like this was actually the Florida Specifier had a conference. Mm-hmm. And so we became their competition, and they quickly got rooted out, and we became the conference to go to.
Right.
When did it really, really take off? In my opinion, when technology kind of caught up with everything and you were able to really get the word out to the masses. Mm-hmm. But I'd say by the early 90s, it was the place for everybody to kind of gather, network, and knew that they kind of needed to be there in order to, you know, be in front of the people that, I mean, some of these times they were trying to get in front of these regulators that they couldn't get in front of otherwise.
Right.
So they would just go to the conference in hopes of, you know, running into them at the, you know, cocktail reception.
Yeah. Is that part of the secret sauce? Because, you know, there are, you know, a lot of folks that show, I was in government for many years, and I would always go not just to learn, but to also be available to people that, you know, that you didn't get a chance to see over the course of the year. It's harder for them, you know, to make the trek to
you. And I've had many speakers tell me in the early days that some of their largest contracts that they ended up having for years and years and years came from that conference. Meeting somebody, having a conversation with somebody at that conference that ended up being a lifelong client for them.
Did Chuck think that this is going to be a decades-long institution at the beginning, or is it just he's just trying to fill a demand?
I think he was filling a demand. I don't think he ever thought that it would get as big as it's gotten. And, you know, he just worked hard from year to year. And like she said, he really just wanted it to. Talking about people coming together, I remember one conference. There was an issue that was about to come down from Washington, D.C. on us. And maybe you guys will remember the issue. I remember Chuck thought, well, why don't we just get everybody at a table? And I remember you got a back room in the restaurant downstairs. The directors of the water management districts were there. Head of our DER was there. Corps of Engineers, somebody from Atlanta was there. There was somebody from Washington, EPA was there. And it was worked out in that back room. Hmm. And it had to do with the fact that what they needed doing, our own DER was going to handle the permitting process.
Hmm.
So basically, instead of the permitting going on in Atlanta or in Washington, D.C., it was done right here in the state of Florida. And they sat around that table and worked that out one night. And it was Chuck's idea to just get them all at the table until they figure it out.
Wow. Something might be like a... I'd assume like stormwater management, like NPDES or something like that, where
I could probably find it in those lists. But I do remember him talking about sometimes it was easy to pull people together because they were already there and work out a problem.
Yeah, those folks would never be in the same spot. I mean, ever, you know, together at the same time.
And that's what goes on today still, to the point that, I mean, some of these sponsors that help, you know, underwrite the cost of the conference and stuff like that, one of the big perks for them is actually having a meeting space, their own private room, where they can grab these people and go in that room and work out a issue.
Yeah. The feedback that y'all get from what you're saying is like in terms of that connection, I've, you know, done it myself. Over the years, you find yourself spending a little bit less time in courses and a little bit more time in those rooms trying to work out challenges, we'll say. But what is it that keeps, other than the things like that, what is it that keep people coming back year after year? Is it because there's also...
They keep changing things.
But there's I think almost on a personal level, is there, you know, the family dynamic to it? Because I think a lot of people, as it becomes something that's important then professionally, it also ends up doubling for many families, including my own, as like part of the plan for summer vacation.
I mean, that's what's made Marco so successful. It's summer vacation for a lot of families, including my own. I think the one of the other ways initially is it was a one-stop shop place that you could go and get all of your Florida bar credits and your engineering credits for the year or for the biennium or whatever that they're, and that carries on to this day, you know.
Did that start early on?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the first conference we actually had the Florida bar credits.
Okay.
And then we added engineers, and then we used to have a whole host of others, and then geologists, we kind of dropped them all, except for the engineers and the attorneys, the two bigs.
What are some, maybe I'll phrase this differently, were there moments you go from about 100 folks, I think last year, if I remember Jeff saying, or Jamie, maybe 1,500 people?
Yeah.
Were there moments as it grew to those kinds of, that magnitude, where the two of you or Chuck were like, man, this is becoming unwieldy. Like, I don't know how we're going to make it work, whether it be the hotel that's become famous as the destination for it or some of the other logistics related to it?
Well, I know my last year was in 22, and we had, you know, obviously had gone through, we were one of the few people that went ahead and did a conference during COVID. It was, to say the least, very challenging. We lost a lot of attendees, but we still had a lot, and the hotel was great in working with us and all of that, and forgiven a lot of things that they typically would not have under the contract you have with them. And I remember after that, it kind of came back with a gangbusters after that, to the point that we were getting like, you know, 11, 12, 1300. And I was starting to think, I don't know where all these people are going to go. How am I going to feed them? Because I knew how much space was there at the Marriott, and we were running tight. I'll be interested to see when I go this year what they've done, because I know they've had to make a lot of changes in that respect to accommodate that many people.
Yeah, because they fill in. I'm like, every year you have the lunches, every year you have the keynote, and people fill that, you know, for those meals, especially those lunch meals.
Yes.
Are filling up that place. And every year it seems to work, no matter how many, you know, how many more people end up, you know, coming down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Any other behind the scenes, funny stories, something that was particularly crazy? Sometimes it may be related to, you know, elected official or something like that.
I've got one. When this was pre, we say BC, before Cindy. we were in a relationship, but I did not make that trip with him down to Marco. And Jeff was 15 or 16 years old. And Chuck came back and he said, well, we had a little problem down there. He said, Jeff figured out that room key will get him anything. and Jeff thought, the chamber's paying for all this.
Oh, boy.
And then Chuck gets the bill. And Chuck said, it was bad. He said, basically, I think I threw an ice cream social for a whole bunch of people I don't know. And he said, and he got a jet ski, I think, or something like a jet ski, and put it on the room. And
sure.
So, yeah, that was a pretty funny story when he came back with
that. Very Ferris Bueller thing.
He had the room key, and he just thought, well, every time he would go to pay for something, they go, are you going to put it on your room? And he'd go, sure. Thinking, wow, this must be free.
It's not real money, yeah. What about you, Linda? Anything come to mind?
I really can't think of any particular funny story. There probably are thousands.
I remember volleyball on the beach there for a while.
Yeah, we used to do all kinds of fun. We used to have volleyball games on the beach. We even had a beach Olympics one year. And Chuck was always, you know, pretty competitive. I remember we used to do a fun run in the mornings, and Colleen and Dennis Barton used to work with us years ago. And Chuck and Colleen and I decided we were going to do the fun run. And I remember Chuck teasing Colleen the whole time, telling her she looked like a little sandpiper running down the beach. And we were teasing Chuck because he looked like, I don't know, Richard Simmons or something out there. He had to do all this stretching this stuff.
That's because he'd have pulled a muscle.
Before he got into his run.
So there are then moments of, you know, most of, you know, my interactions with you over the years, Linda, was, you're getting it done, but it's, you know, it's moving huge swaths of people around a conference. But were you able to kind of mix in those things a little more often than maybe I pictured? It seemed to me that it was like a week of suffering.
Well, for me, it was work. I mean, it was not vacation. Although my family was like, oh, let's do it. And I'm like, you know, I'm working. And I took it very seriously because I was very proud of what Chuck and I had accomplished and put together and grew. I grew up, like I said, military. My dad was a very disciplined person. And thank the good Lord that got instilled in me. And so I've always been very organized person. And
Chuck is not an organized person.
No, he's not. And well, part of why it worked. It was like he used to frustrate the heck out of me because, you know, here I am with my little list, 1, 2, 3, and Chuck would just, mid-sentence on number one, he'd be off on something else. And we would be meeting sometimes, trying to work out the actual format of the course or who was going to be speaking on what panel and all that. The phone would ring, and Chuck would answer it every time. And I would sit there and try to be patient while he had a conversation with somebody else about something totally different. And I used to get so mad. And I'm like, that is so rude. But I'm like, I'm the secretary. He's the boss. Suck it up. But I did, you know, it was all work for me. And I wanted it to come off smoothly. That was my main goal every year, was that there were, you know, no mistakes, no problems, no big issues that came up. And there rarely were. So I'm proud of that.
Do you feel the pressure of that too, Cindy? And like as part of, you know, that week, it's you know, there's a lot
riding
on it. It
wasn't pressure for me. A lot of that time I spent about 13 years in the middle of that working for the state of Florida. Mm-hmm. And so I really couldn't help them. You know, if someone found out that I was working for the state, drawing money, sure, and then working with them, I was in big trouble.
It seemed more like vicarious pain.
Yeah, you know? What I'd do, because I was a lobbyist, I would, for the state, I would plan my meetings with people that I needed in that area. Mm. And a lot of times during the day, I'd take off and go to those meetings and find other things to do. And then the rest of the time, I got to hang out and do nothing. So these guys,
I don't think it was stressful for Chuck at all. I think the stress for him came if he was having these side meetings trying to work out a deal for a client or something like that. But the actual conference, he trusted his team.
How much of that original vision by Chuck do you still see in summer school? I mean, is it still
100%? Yeah,
it is. Jeff and the girls, all of them, and now Ryan. And, you know, it's kind of neat that Ryan's father was so involved. Ryan grew up in it just like Jeff did. It's 100%. I'd say the only real difference is the technology side of things.
Mm. Right.
And Jamie and Tracy have really jumped into that and brought that forward.
Yeah, say, other than...
And that's you asked me a question earlier. Mm-hmm. What would Chuck be most proud of? I think the family, mostly Jeff, and then the fact that, you know, Jamie and Tracy are both involved in it too. Mm-hmm. Tracy almost totally technology, because she does it from Atlanta. She's not down here. So
Yeah. And so you, I mean, so you really, I mean, aside from, gosh, I mean, almost a complete torch, you know, picking up and carrying, like you said, with the addition of Ryan and Frank Matthews was such a huge personality and part of, you know, the environmental sphere in Florida. Yeah, but aside from Jamie and all, like the, you think that he'd still be proud of how it's working?
Yeah, I think it's working just like he had it set up. The issues change.
I do too, just on a much grander scale.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
I think he would be amazed if he really understood it, how big it is now. Mm. Chuck doesn't even read anymore, so I don't know how much of it he understands. But he'll be there, and you'll think he's fine.
Yep.
Well, and I will have to say also from my perspective on the whole family unit and family dynamic, I have, you know, obviously been part of the Little John family for a long, long time. And I remember well going and picking Jeff up when he was like 12 years old from camp when he would come spend the summers with his dad. So, yeah, I feel old. And then when Tracy and Jamie came along through Cindy and all that, watching those girls grow up. And then when Chuck ended up retiring and kind of turning the reins over to Jeff, we hired Jamie to help me. Mm-hmm. And I spent 7 years with her before she ended up taking over my position, which I advocated strongly for, and I couldn't be more proud of what she's done.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, you know, because you poured a ton of yourself into it, you know, over many decades, and so, I mean, are you still proud of, you know, not just the work that Jamie's doing, but kind of the legacy of
absolutely
of the conference?
Absolutely.
Can you give me, just on the Chuck thing, is there some memory of, you know, him at summer school that maybe best captures, and it could be something from the 80s, it could be something from 5 years ago, that captures kind of the spirit of Chuck and why he did it? The Chuck Little John stamp on the conference.
We used to, obviously, and still do, design these t-shirts that are given out every year. And along with the brochures, Chuck, for somebody who is colorblind, was very opinionated when it came to the colors and stuff, all these brochures and
I had the same
t-shirts.
Problem in the house decorating. But I mean, the man is colorblind.
Insisted this one year when Ginger Weatherall was secretary of
DER and then DER. She was both.
Okay.
She
okay.
was the
anyway,
the
and
merger.
This is the same time frame that the movie Jurassic Park came out. Mm. So Chuck came up with the idea and he was insistent on it, and it actually turned out very cute. The t-shirt was called Gingerastic Park.
Yeah, in Jurassic Park, right. It was cute.
Oh,
and there was a T-Rex on the front of
uh-huh.
it. And I think the T-Rex had a, you know, Ginger used to have a mm-hmm. White, I guess before she got all white, she had a little stripe. It was on him, too.
I gave Jamie all the T-shirts, too. I had all the old T-shirts, and I finally boxed all those up.
Right,
and, yeah.
Right.
Will they be down this
over.
Year? Like, are there mementos that are going to make it for
I
the
hope.
40th?
They are. I think they're going to have a display with a lot of the T-shirts and things.
That'd be great. It's a hot commodity. I mean, I just, hearing people like, that's the thing. Like, I wasn't huge on the T-shirt. And like, some people are,
mm-hmm.
it's
oh,
very
to the
important.
Point that they would, you know, come get a large and then decide they would need to exchange it for a medium, and it's like, I mean, it was a whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And the people would come up to you and hold it up. Do you think I can wear a medium? And you're like, no, how about an extra large? That's all we got left.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, there's a real run on those T-shirts sometimes.
Well, thank you both for the conversation. Thanks for the walk down memory lane. The 40th is going to be really cool, and I can't wait to see you both down there and spend a little time, you know, reminiscing while we're down on Marco Island as well. So I'll say Lena Dickinson, Sinead Littlejohn, thank you so much. Been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you. I enjoyed it, and I'm looking forward to it as well. I hope I see a lot of people I hadn't seen in a long time.
Yeah. What a great conversation. Thanks for listening to the Florida Specifier podcast. If you like what you hear, please be sure to hit subscribe on whatever platform you use to listen. And don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review. I recommend subscribing to the Florida Specifier online at floridaspecifier.com and read your environmental news and commentary the new old-fashioned way. But please subscribe. It's easy, inexpensive, and offers a ton of ways to read, watch, listen, and learn at your fingertips. Your support is always greatly appreciated. Production of this podcast is by Carl Soren and David Barfield at Lonely Fox Studios. And we want to thank Bagels and Biscuits for letting us use their music for the podcast. Join us next time as we delve into the issues, policy, and people that environmental professionals and policymakers want to know about. So for my friend Ryan Matthews, I'm Brett Cyphers. We'll see you next time.